3,000 and counting. That's how many of your original short stories we've received so far in our 3-Minute Fiction Summer Writing Contest. That works out to about 150 hours of fiction, and it's kept all of us here pretty busy, but it's also been great fun. And I hope it's also been fun for our series guide, James Wood, who's been reading steadily as well. James, welcome back.
Thank you.
So did you have any idea of what you were getting into when we launched this series a few weeks back?
Absolutely not. Absolutely not. It's overwhelming. It's huge.
Let's just quickly recap the rules. We asked our listeners to send us original works of fiction that can be read in about 3 minutes or less, so roughly 500 words. And we're going to announce a winner in a few weeks. But in the meantime, James, could you read us some passages from some of the stories you liked?
Yeah. One of them is by Molly Reed, entitled Not That I Care. And it falls into that category of someone remembering a lost love, but it really avoids any of the pitfalls of sentimentality and is full of vividness. It begins like this. There goes our neighbor Jim running into the street again. He grabs one of the ducks crossing, doesn't even look to see if anyone is looking, just scampers out, hunched over, elbows bent, and reaching behind him like he's trying to grow wings or is throwing himself to the asphalt, then scoops a duck and holds it with both hands close to his chest, and runs back into his house. This has been going on for 2 weeks, started around the time Marcus left, or at least that's when I first noticed it. That's the beginning, and the story keeps you close to it because of the way she deals with details. So a little bit later, the narrator talks about looking out of the window and chewing off the extra tiny bits of skin inside my cheeks. And then a little bit later, a very vivid detail, she says, when Marcus left, he left behind a pair of dirty socks, one hiding under the bed and one right in plain sight, curled into itself and getting smaller every day like a sad little salted slug. It's that kind of thing that I'm looking for in a story that just makes the whole piece immediately alive.
And in that case, the language is very clean.
Yes, and I think the strongest stories here understand that you're probably going to have to make the thing fairly spare and simple, and push it on with voice.
We'll read us some more.
Yeah, well, to give you an example of voice, here's a terrific little story called Plum Street by Bernard Mendillo, and it just begins like this. In the fifth grade, there was a boy named Plum Street. That wasn't his real name. We called him Plum Street because he came from the project. Even the nuns called him Plum Street. Sister Mary Snapper, we called her the Whip, didn't like Plum Street and beat him nearly every day for something. Where's your homework? The Whip would ask. I ain't got no homework, Plum Street would sneer. And no matter how many times she hit him with a pointer over the hand, he would never cry. He wasn't afraid of her. He wasn't afraid of anything. Now that's pretty much the model, I would say, of what I'm looking for. And I think it shows us what detail does, which is to speed us into a made world, in this case, the world of the school child.
James, reading through some of these stories myself, I've noticed some wonderful titles. The Communist from Pasadena, Sleeping with Leopold Bloom, the Last Days of Entropy. They almost seem to be like little stories of their own, just in the titles.
That's right. And I think that those writers understand that every sentence speaks, including the title. The title itself can be a gnomic sign for something to come. You mentioned The Last Days of Entropy. I selected that for this week because it's one of the few linguistically daring and experimental stories we've had. Most of them are pretty committed to standard realism. And this is written in an entirely made-up, futuristic sort of computer language. It's by Ming Ivor. It's called The Last Days of Entropy. It begins like this. The experiment has come a cropper on a public key for the archive. A good day? The pumps work and thinking is easy, but I've noticed a quant of anomalies lately and thought I'd better document the glitchy in case my fix flops and I'm hauled up on incompetence. And so it goes on like that. She even uses the verb Orwelling. So, in fact, I suspect they've been Orwelling blueprints for so long, few really know. It's great.
Yeah.
And I choose it because I think it's, you know, one should reward the more daring writer like that.
James Wood is literary critic at The New Yorker, as well as the guide and judge of our series, 3-Minute Fiction. James, thanks so much and happy reading.
Thank you very much.
And James will announce our winning story in a few weeks. If you want to enter or read some of the stories highlighted today, go to our website. That's npr.org/3-Minute Fiction. That's 3-Minute Fiction, all spelled out, no spaces. And thanks to everyone who's written in so far. Yesterday, we brought you a story of sex, the annual mating frenzy of horseshoe crabs on the beaches of Delaware Bay. The results of that giant orgy? Billions of crab eggs covering the shore. That's where we start today's installment. It's a tale of gluttony by tens of thousands of shorebirds who fly in to gorge themselves on those eggs. Quite a few human visitors come along as well. This year, Louisa Jonas from member station WYPR in Baltimore is one of them.
A lanky man in a floppy hat and windbreaker is hiding behind shrubbery on a beach in Miss Pillion Harbor.
Put myself really low and just literally nose forward.
Nigel Clark is from the British Trust for Ornithology. He's peering through his scope, trying to read tags on the legs of hundreds of migratory shorebirds feeding in front of him.
Ah, I think I can just see Brazilian marked bird. It's amazing on these beaches just to think that we can see birds that we know have been marked in Brazil or Argentina. The very southern tip of South America, right at the southern tip of Terra del Fuego. That's where the majority of these birds are coming from.
Nigel is particularly interested in the redknot, a chestnut-colored bird about the size of a robin. The redknots winter in Argentina, but fly 10,000 miles to the high Arctic to breed. To prepare for their journey, they shrink their own digestive organs and turn the tissue into fuel to burn in flight. By the time they look down on the shores of the Delaware Bay, they're really hungry.
When a bird arrives, they are literally skin and bone. Very little on them at all. They look very thin, sleek birds, running around with extremely long legs, it seems.
Delaware is the redknot's most important feeding stop on their trip. They time their arrival to perfectly coincide with the annual horseshoe crab spawning here. The crabs lay billions of pearly green caviar-sized eggs. Many of these eggs would just dry out or wash away, but instead, they become a banquet for the migratory shorebirds.
So the birds feeding on really, the surplus eggs in the population, it really is a case of nature's bounty that they're taking, rather than a fact that the birds are stopping the crabs breeding.
The redknots only have a few weeks to build up enough fat reserves to fuel their last leg of their journey. They eat so greedily that stretches of sand can be completely hidden by their red breasts and little pecking heads.
By the time they're ready to go, they are like little balls, is the best way of putting it. They are round. They look like they have short legs because they are carrying so much fat on their breast. And they almost waddle. They are so heavy.
So I think we should celebrate the lot of arrival.
Nigel heads back to a beach house not far from Miss Pillion Harbor. He's one of 20 or so volunteers who gather here every year as part of the Delaware Shorebird Project. There are sleeping bags in every corner, tied in moon charts on the walls. A sign on the oven reads, "Do not touch, drying feathers."
When we fire the net, we need to get people out to it very quickly. Be very careful.
Jackie Clark is Nigel's wife and also works for the Trust. She says the bounty of crab eggs in Delaware that's available only in late spring is an example of nature's mysterious synchronicity. The redknots need that fuel to get to the Arctic to breed, and they need to get there exactly when there will be plenty of food for their chicks. And that's only for 2 short months in the summer.
But hopefully they get the timing just right. It's really critical. They arrive just as the snow melts, and they can lay their clutch of eggs really quickly. Then, as their chicks hatch, it should be just about the same time the insects hatch as well. So the chicks get the maximum food.
But something's gone wrong for the redknots. Nigel says the population's crashed since the 1990s. The red knot is a candidate species under the Endangered Species Act. Climate change may be affecting when the ground thaws in the Arctic. There may not be enough horseshoe crab eggs in Delaware to fatten up the birds. The volunteers head off the next morning to see if the birds are gaining enough weight. On the beach at Mispillion Harbor, the team sets up a cannon net, which uses gunpowder to blast a net over hundreds of feeding shorebirds. Wings flap, and the birds bounce up and down like popcorn, struggling to escape. The volunteers gently peel back the net and lift the birds out, sometimes two or three in a handful, and place them into ventilated boxes. The team gets to work, weighing, measuring, banding, and taking feather samples.
Hello, one more. There we go. Here you go, baby.
The crew returns to the beach house. Nigel and the other volunteers crunch the data with hopes that the birds are plumping up. Soon, they'll have to fly 2,500 miles to the Arctic in 5 days without stopping.
Red Knot and Delaware Bay in the Americas is absolutely intertwined and critical. There is nowhere else in the world where a population of birds is so dependent on such a small area. And if they don't have Delaware Bay, they won't get to the Arctic, they won't breed, and the population will die out. It's as simple as that.
This year turns out to have been a pretty good year for the red knots in Delaware. But in order for the population to recover, the birds need several good years in a row. Not just in Delaware, but in Argentina and in the Arctic. For NPR News, this is Luisa Jonas.
And if you missed the first part of our story, you can hear it at npr.org. You can also see photos of the crabs and of the birds they keep plump. A correction now. In our story yesterday about how homeless people cope with the summer heat of Phoenix, we actually underestimated just how hot it gets there. We said today's forecast called for a high of 114. That's 2 degrees off the all-time record. Well, a former Phoenix resident, Gary Owen, reminded us that the mercury hit 122 degrees in June of 1990. And right now, it's a cool 112.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Leanne Hansen. Many of the sounds of New Orleans are well known. The jazz of Louis Armstrong. And the hip-hop of Lil Wayne. Then there are the lesser-known sounds. That was the sound of a tap dancer in the French Quarter. It came from the website opensoundneworleans.com. The site is part of a project that aims to archive the sounds of the city. That's a brass band playing at Super Sunday. I'm looking at the site now as I sit in the studio. The directors of the project, Jacob Prancazzi and Heather Booth, are at member station WWNO in New Orleans to tell us more about the project. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, Leanne.
Thanks for having us.
This is very exciting. It looks like a Google map, and then there are all these little icons all over the place. How is the website organized?
Well, Leanne, what you're looking at is what we call a sound map of the city of New Orleans, and those icons represent voices, ambient sounds, and music, and they're what we call sound marks, which are sort of landmarks of sound.
How did you put this landmark of sounds together?
Well, it's a community media project, and so we encourage the people of our city to record the sounds and voices and to upload them to the sound map, and we loan equipment and do trainings with people to help make that happen.
Why did you decide to organize the city sounds like this?
The three categories of voices, ambient, and music just seem to be pretty natural ways to divide up all of the recordings that we've gotten from contributors. We decided to organize them geographically because people tend to want to hear the things that happen in their own neighborhood or on their own beaten path. So it's an accessible way for people to access the recordings that people have contributed.
Hmm. This is such a different way to understand a city. I mean, I'm not seeing photos. It's mostly sounds. Why did you want to use sound to document the city?
Well, New Orleans is really a sound-rich city. Everybody does a lot of their living outdoors, and we hear a lot. The fruit man, the ice cream man, the second line.
The brass band is what we call the main line, and people run out of their houses and follow them and dance and just spend time together. And those people that are following the band are what we call the second line, but it's also just what we call sort of the whole event. You often hear it when you're in your house, and it just sometimes pulls you right out of your house. You just have to go running out behind it.
I see you've also collected some of the sounds into themed tags. There's a tag for food, one for Mardi Gras, but you also have one called Pirate and another one named Smelly. I mean, how many different sounds make up a city like New Orleans?
We don't know yet, but we're hoping that people continue to contribute to the point where they feel that the map really represents the city well.
Yeah, and people can tag sounds however you like. So what you're seeing is how people have chosen to sort of succinctly describe their recordings. But there are also tags that might seem a little more boring on their face, like businesses, and even those have some really great recordings in them.
Give us an example.
Well, if you click the businesses tag, you should see an interview with Ed Buckner Pie Man that was contributed by Eve Trow.
Since 1980, I've been walking the neighborhoods selling pies, saying, fresh hot pies, get them while they're hot. Apple, pecan, lemon meringue, and sweet potato pies, get them while they're hot, because they're hot when you get them. And we'll walk through the projects and everything, selling those pies. Well, you know, if you holler fresh hot pies, I might work on your nerves, and you might decide, I'm going to get buy a pie from this man so he can go about his business.
Ed's selling pies, but he's not only selling pies. He's participating in the city's culture by sort of chanting this way.
So how is that indicative of New Orleans?
I think it's about collaboration. So, you know, Ed comes out and he does his thing, and then people come out of their houses and they buy pie. And just like the second line pulls you out of your house and, you know, the band has to play really well and you have to get in line and dance for it to all work well. You know, it's a collaboration, and there's a lot of instances of that in New Orleans.
What do you hope visitors will get from your site that they might not understand about New Orleans from other kinds of websites about the city?
Well, one of our favorite aspects about the project is learning new things from what people contribute, and we hope that anyone who visits the site does the same. 14-year-old Khadijah Garner gave us a vocabulary lesson. Here, she explains the T.
The T is the like information, what's going on, the today's news, something like that. But it's more like, again, it's with your friends. It's not like news that's really going around the world. It's like your classroom or your neighborhood. I tell my sister about what happened at school or something. She'll tell me about what happened at her school or what happened with my cousin. You know, I'd be like, let me give you the T right quick. Because the T, it sounds better, like the T. Let me give you the topic of the day.
If you visit the site, you can listen to the other words in Khadijah's vocabulary lesson. It's just one example of the way people share personal experiences and offer local knowledge on the site.
You know, we really feel like none of the recordings speak entirely to what New Orleans is, but if you go and listen to enough of them, you can start to get a real sense of the city.
Thank you.
That's the sound of the steamboat Natchez Calliope, and it was contributed by Chris Welker. Heather Booth and Jacob Brancazzi are the directors of the OpenSoundNewOrleans.com project. They were also our tour guides through the website today, and they joined us from member station WWNO in New Orleans. Thank you, Heather.
Thanks, Leanne.
Thank you, Jacob.
Thanks for having us.
You can listen to more sounds from the city at opensoundneworleans.com. And to learn about Maker's Quest, our summer multimedia project, go to npr.org. Nearly 10 years ago, Sarah McGid became obsessed with all things sweet, cakes, cookies, candy. At the time, she was working as a shoe designer for Tommy Hilfiger by day and experimenting with baked treats by night. One day, her 3-year-old son asked for a box of Twinkies, a snack food that McGid's parents never let her eat. After she read the ingredients on the package, she understood why. To avoid what she calls a DEFCON 3 meltdown, McGid whipped up a batch of Twinkies with organic ingredients, and she calls them Goldies. Sarah McGid has written Organic and Chic, a cookbook of recipes for organic sweets and baked goods, and yes, it does include a recipe for those Goldies, and she joins us from the studios of Chicago Public Radio. Welcome to the program, Sarah.
Thank you for having me.
So basically, if Goldies is your organic take on the infamous Twinkies, what exactly is in the recipe?
Well, I sort of divert from having it be a vanilla sponge cake and go towards the chocolate cake because that's the most popular cake that's requested of me. So it's a dark chocolate sponge cake that is filled with an organic whipped vanilla buttercream and coated in a dark chocolate glaze. And then I chill them and dust them with an edible gold metallic powder. And it's sort of my influence from loving jewelry and fashion that adds a little sparkly touch.
Does it end up being more expensive than, I mean, maybe better for you, but a little bit gold dust?
A little goes a long way, so it's not as expensive. And in general, organic ingredients have come down in price as people are buying more and more of it, so it's accessible.
Don't you think organic junk food is an oxymoron?
Well, you know, I'm a mom of two. You know, I'm not going to shelter my kids from the world of candy and cakes. There's birthday parties, there's weddings, there's all kinds of celebrations. And I think we all deserve to have sweets in our life. And kids and adults are always going to be eating chocolate and cake. And it's better to have it be organic than none at all.
I'm looking at these cakes in the book and wow, I mean, so many of them look like they, you know, you should be on Martha Stewart or something. I mean, you have a recipe for the easiest chocolate cake, and yet all these flowers are on it and decorated. Yes. I mean, isn't this tough for the normal person to do?
Well, the thing that I try to include in Organic and Chic is tips of decorating for people who really want to have an involved project, for example, a do-it-yourself bride, but also somebody who just wants to make a really great cake for their child's first birthday. So you don't have to have a cake covered in the hand-sculpted flowers, but that's something if you want to take the time and try your hand at something special, you can do it.
Did you find that there were some things that you tried that you found that you couldn't make organically?
There are some elements to cake decorating, such as fondant or even gum paste, that guar gum, which is one of the ingredients in that, doesn't come organic. It's natural, but it's not organic. So I found it a stumbling block to recreate everything that I found in decorating. In terms of the baking, I didn't find any obstacles because there pretty much now is everything available organic that you can find in conventional ingredients.
Now, most of the recipes in here come from family members or memories you've had of family meals. And we mentioned that your parents didn't let you eat Twinkies. So
Well, I grew up in a Jewish home, so we were not allowed to eat things that were not kosher. So that was one element of it. And the other was that they were really into health food. You know, growing up in Southern California in the early 80s, there were health food stores everywhere. In our own backyard, we had tons of fruits and everything that we would eat from it. But in a way, that's why the Goldies are made with chocolate cake, because I'm creating my own memory of Twinkies since I was never allowed to eat them. So it always seemed to me that a Twinkie should be with chocolate, because that's a better flavor than vanilla.
But you also have some dessert memories. I'm looking at the recipe that you have for Grandma Eva's Mandelbrot.
Yes. She was a crazy grandmother of mine who always wore tons of jewelry, red nail polish, was a jazz singer, and she would just come over and bake, and whatever we had in our pantry, she would just put it all together really haphazardly and come up with these great cookies. And so it's my homage to her. She passed away a while ago, but her spirit is something that I always think about when I'm in the kitchen, and I just feel like everyone in their life has a Grandma Eva, even if they're not related to them. And that kind of whimsical, fun spirit is what that recipe sort of is all about.
Sarah McGid runs a custom-made cake business in New York City, and she's the author of a new cookbook, Organic and Chic, published by William Morrow. She joined us from the studios of Chicago Public Radio. Thanks so much, Sarah.
Thank you so much.
Ohio is one state that's had a lot of trouble translating the money from President Obama's stimulus package into new jobs, and a poll indicates that Ohioans are holding the president accountable for that. A Quinnipiac University poll shows that President Obama's approval rating in Ohio is at 49%, sharply down from a 62% approval rating in May. Even fewer Ohioans approve of how he's handling the economy. Here to give us a sense of the mood in Ohio is Connie Schultz. She's a Pulitzer Prize-winning columnist for the Cleveland Plain Dealer, and she joins us from member station WCPN in Cleveland. Welcome to the show, Connie.
Thank you.
We want to start with a clip from NPR's Morning Edition last week. Senator Sherrod Brown, who happens to be your husband, said this in response to a question from Steve Inskeep.
I think people in the House and Senate and most of the public is thinking, and particularly in my state, and whether it's Dayton or Akron or Cleveland, that let's see how this stimulus is working. Once more money's in the pipeline, especially in the next couple of quarters, then we will reassess, but I don't think you make a decision on a stimulus yet when this one is not played even 50% out yet.
But it sounds like Ohioans aren't willing to wait a few months, at least according to this poll. They seem to be assessing the impact of the stimulus money now. Connie, do you think that the poll is really an accurate reflection of how people in Ohio feel right now?
I do, to be really honest with you. In anticipation of this, of our conversation today, I just started asking everybody I saw, you know, and uniformly. I mean, the language is so similar, and their responses are saying, I don't see it. And what's interesting to me is so many of them are talking about unemployment. I talked to a guard at the front desk in a building I was coming in earlier today, and he said, where's the unemployment rate? Why is it still going up? Why hasn't it come down yet? I think part of it, though, too, is Ohioans felt so beaten up before the recession really hit, you know, the Great Recession, as we're calling it now, because we were already in a recession. And by 2006, we had lost more than 250,000 manufacturing jobs.
So what has Ohio been doing with the stimulus money?
Well, there have been projects going on. In Zanesville, there's a weatherization program where they've hired 100 workers, I think a little bit more than 100, and they've already trained them on how to weatherize homes of low-income families and senior citizens. And apparently about 100 more are going to be added soon in that. So that's an example. And in Defiance County, they're going to be doing, I think, a couple of things, but mainly the River Project, which is a big sewage project, frankly. I mean, it's not a sexy thing. It's infrastructure we're talking about. And in fact, that's, I think, a lot of what is happening right now that doesn't create the number of jobs people were thinking it was going to create right away. And I do think we need to keep in mind this. Only a quarter of the stimulus money has been dispersed so far. It sounds to me that they're going to have to speed this up. But we also have a state budget that hasn't been resolved yet. And so we're not even able to get the full amount of the federal money we normally would get. And I know we're not the exception in that, but it's a glaring problem in Ohio because people are already hurting so much.
So patience is running out in your state.
Yes, but yes, it is. I don't think, I mean, something's got to give. I do see our communities pulling together in ways they haven't before, but I'm also just sensing such a weariness in people in Ohio. But it is heartbreaking to watch the suffering and having them constantly asking, how much longer?
Connie Schultz is a columnist with the Plain Dealer newspaper in Cleveland, and she joined us from member station WCPN in Cleveland. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Leanne Hansen. Congress returned to Washington after its July 4th break this past week and went straight to work on its top agenda item, health care. Now, depending on which day or sometimes which hour you paid attention to the news, efforts to reach an agreement on a large-scale health overhaul bill were either going very well or very badly. NPR's Julie Rovner is here to explain where things really stand. Hi, Julie.
Hi, Leanne.
Prospects for an agreement got a boost this past week when Vice President Joe Biden announced a deal with hospitals to give up $150 billion to help pay for an overhaul bill. And then the very next day, the Senate was in disarray when polls showed that the public didn't want to tax health benefits. So, is this effort moving forward or backward?
Yes. Both. And that's, you know, what happens so often with really big legislation like this. There is so much truth in that old saw that you should never watch law or sausage being made. There is a lot of interest in this, as there should be. We're talking about a sixth of the economy here. But charting the daily ups and downs of this is like watching the stock market by the hour, when what you're really interested in is the value of your 401k 30 years from now when you retire. It goes up and down and up and down, but those hourly fluctuations don't really tell you all that much.
Are they still shooting for an August deadline to get bills passed in the House and Senate?
Well, that is indeed the hope. Right now, there's five committees, two in the Senate and three in the House, that are working on this. They're all falling a little bit behind, but there's enough cushion that it still looks like the House may be able to get its bill passed before it leaves at the end of July. Whether the Senate can get its bill passed before it leaves a week after that, that's going to be a harder push given the calendar. On the other hand, that was always really ambitious. But if this lapses into the fall, it really won't be the end of the process. Everybody thought that might happen anyway.
Now, most of what we've been hearing is about big issues, whether there will be a government health plan is one example. What are some of the other things in these bills that are going unnoticed?
You know, I'm sort of surprised at how many really big things there are that haven't gotten almost any attention. One of them, for instance, in the bill that was written by Senator Ted Kennedy, is a long-term care program. Big long-term care program. It would be funded by premiums that working people would pay. These would be taken out of your paycheck unless you said no. It would fund community-based long-term care. This is a huge issue as the baby boomers age that almost nobody is looking at. And it's in there. It's a big program.
Anything else?
Well, yeah, and this has gotten somewhat more attention, mostly because Republicans have been criticizing it. But also in that same Kennedy Senate bill, there's something called community transformation grants. The idea here is to prevent health expenses, really, by emphasizing prevention programs that can range from anything from encouraging people to quit smoking to encouraging healthier options on restaurant menus to installing lights on walking paths so people can walk at night. There's also some more health insurance-specific things that haven't gotten much attention. For example, in all the bills, women would get a much fairer shake in insurance coverage than they do now. Insurers, for instance, would be required to cover maternity care. A lot don't do that now. And insurers wouldn't be able to charge women more because women tend to use more health care services than men do.
So will all of these things end up in the final bill?
Well, first, that assumes there will be a final bill. That's by no means definite yet. But there's still a lot of giving and taking to be done. We are still early in this process, so we'll all have to stay tuned.
NPR's Julie Rovner. Thanks, Julie.
You're welcome.